You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, I'm Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. This show brings you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, and dealing with addictions. We will introduce you to specialized schools and treatment programs that can really help, and educational consultants that can help you determine which school or program is right for your child. With over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate enough to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field. I will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today one such talented professional in Dr. Danny Levine. Dr. DeLevine is a licensed psychologist, educational consultant, and founder of the Step Group. Her expertise in psychological and educational testing assists her in identifying emotional, learning, social, and behavioral problems, which proves beneficial in the placement process. Dr. Levine's group has extensive knowledge in therapeutic options for at-risk teens. Her clinical expertise makes her highly qualified to match struggling students with therapeutic schools and programs across the country. Dr. Levine, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alan.
I'm so glad to finally get you here. So one of the first questions, so that our audience will know, can you tell our audience, what do the initials STEP stand for?
STEP stands for, it's an acronym for School Testing and Educational Placement.
That's wonderful. Tell us a little bit about the group and what, you know, what you're bringing to the families out there.
The group was derived, initially I was an outpatient therapist working with families and working primarily doing therapy. I started doing testing and found that as a result of that there was a need as a roadmap to use the testing to figure out next steps. And as far as the next steps, families needed help in assisting what to do. The recommendations born out of the assessment then were used to provide, as I said, a roadmap in figuring out how to help families. And with that, I used that to do the placement piece.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this helps you offer better services to the parents and the teenagers?
It is a comprehensive approach. So in terms of working with the families, we're always looking at the whole system. As far as the assessment goes, we are testing the children specifically and teenagers, but the entire picture needs to be looked at within the system.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the testing. In other words, how do you evaluate a child to assess their specific risk level?
Typically, the testing is broken down into four different components. So the first component would be comprised of cognitive testing, and that's typically IQ testing, and that gives us a really good baseline in terms of what kind of expectations one should have for that child. The second component is comprised of an educational piece, and that's looking at reading and writing and math and the educational components, which are then compared again to that baseline of a child's abilities. And the third component is a neuropsychological component. It looks at executive functioning skills such as memory and acquiring information and planning and so forth. And then the last component, which is oftentimes the most essential component in looking at the placement piece, is the social-emotional component. So that gives us a really good idea of what's going on psychologically for that child.
Okay. And how does that how does it transfer to the family? So I think we all know that it didn't just happen.
Correct. Most of the time, I would say, in 90% of the families we work with, the parents are always asking the question, why? Unfortunately, through testing, we cannot answer the why questions. Mm-hmm. We can really only answer what's going on at the present time. So when we're looking at a full evaluation, it's an understanding of a full diagnostic picture and profile of that child at that given moment. It doesn't necessarily predict the future, as far as I'm concerned, and it doesn't really talk so much about the past, of the etiology of why this child is the way that they are. So in terms of understanding the assessment, it's really, as I said, used as a guide to figure out where that child currently is and to figure out a plan for the future.
Okay. Now, are you setting up plans for the family as a whole? In other words, is there a plan for the parents so that they can recognize what their part has been in it?
Absolutely. I think when families come in, it's always interesting that one or both parents will identify with that child and say, I had very similar mm-hmm. kind of struggles when I was growing up. So that's always helpful because it resonates for them. As far as looking, again, using a family systems approach, I think is really critical. I do not believe in treating children in a vacuum. I think that children really need to be looked at within the context of the entire family structure. So that does include parents. It includes bringing parents into the feedback. So when children are assessed, parents come in at the end and they get verbal feedback. So they sit across from typically two professionals and they're hearing exactly what's going on for their child. Then we take that information and translate that into a what now plan. And that does include parents. The parents are involved. In fact, we haven't talked much about the placement mm-hmm. part, but when we do placement with families, whether it's on a local level or a residential level, parents are always involved in the treatment plan. And typically parents are asked to be in some form of therapy.
Now, in this time and age of massive amounts of divorce, how much more difficult is that now that you're dealing with two separate families?
Well, I do have a way, within the office, we do have a procedure where we do not see parents separately. So if anybody
Excellent.
Wants to come in, they are asked whether they can stand each other or not. They're asked to be in the room at the same time and to tolerate each other. I think that's a really good first step for the parents understanding why they're there, that it's not about them, it's about their child, and to put the child first. So like I said, part of our policy in the office is that parents cannot come in. I know there are some cases where parents will have full legal custody. In those cases, we still encourage both parents to be involved in the process from the get-go.
And I couldn't agree more. And one of the things that we have is we have some listener questions. And I want to ask you a few of those. I actually ended up not asking some a couple of shows ago. And they emailed me back asking how come I didn't ask their question. So I said, we've only got 50 minutes, but let me get some of these questions out. One of them we have is, it says, if I have a child who is asking for help in school and tutors don't work, I try not to change them either. So sometimes it doesn't flow real well. It says, nothing seems to work. What's my next step?
It's a good question, a question that frequently comes up in the practice is we've exhausted what feels like all of the options and resources out there, and nothing seems to work. I think that families need to look at, again, the possibility of doing an evaluation, because the evaluation, whether it's done privately or the school districts, through the school districts, they really do get more pertinent information about getting a specific plan for their child. So once they acquire that information then can be used to develop the plan. And when I say the plan, it's usually not tutors, but really specialists who work with kids, whether they're called educational coaches, sometimes educational therapists. They go by different names under different guises, but usually these are people who are trained to look at diagnostic findings and use that information to come up with an individualized plan for that child based on how they learn, how they process, what are their strengths and weaknesses, and then to take that information to guide them to figure out how to help their child.
Well, and you touch on a great thing, and that is the IEP. Can you explain a little bit about what that is and how a parent gets that through the school district? Because I think there's a lot of parents out there that really don't understand what that is or that they even have a right to it.
It's become, over the years, I've been doing testing and placement for about 15 years now, and it's become more and more difficult to obtain IEPs these days. It used to be that you would go in and you would put something in writing requesting an IEP, and it was pretty much a done deal. Now it's a little bit more, there's more red tape involved in the process, so it's not as easy to obtain an IEP these days. In fact, schools can come back and say, we are not going to test your child. We don't see anything going on. Their grades look good, their standardized test scores look great, and there's no need to do an evaluation. So schools can come back and deny the request. However, it really requires what I call survival of the fittest as far as families persevering with this and continuing to push for the IEP. So the first step would be for families to go in to put something in writing requesting it. Typically, it's a good idea to ask why they're requesting it, to put something in writing of the why, of what is generating their request. And it has to be driven by a concern. It's not just because I want my child tested because every other child is being tested and I have a right. It has to be because they're struggling, they're taking too long to complete their work, they're manifesting behavior problems at home, we feel that they're at risk for failing, whatever it might be, for them to include that in their request. Then the next step is within 15 days, the district is required to respond to that parent and give them a plan. And that plan will include exactly the dates in which their child will be evaluated. From there, there's another timeline in which they have to complete the evaluation, 50 days, and that testing will then be culminated and parents will come in for a meeting. That doesn't necessarily mean it's an IEP. It means that they will be getting feedback for that child's evaluation. That's where the IEP typically would start from there. Once they complete the evaluation process and they come in armed with the testing, they can then request what they need to request as far as services.
Right. And I would imagine that the way our economy is right now, it's only going to get more difficult.
I would say that so. I think more and more families are looking to do that. And the other part I would add is many, many families need to go in, when I say armed, also with an advocate. So families today are hiring people who are experts in the field of understanding their rights and can go in and help them. However, it's not necessary that they have an advocate, but oftentimes it's recommended, especially as they hit the wall with this.
Right, yeah, and that is another industry that has grown.
Definitely.
So one of the listener questions we have is, we have one that says, I have a young boy who has hit puberty and has seemed to lose his mind, throwing tantrums, stealing, and being basically disrespectful. Is this something I can solve with basic discipline? What do you suggest?
I don't know if I have the panacea for that.
I know.
It sounds like many of the kids that I work with in my practice, and that unfortunately at times leads to placement. But I do say to parents frequently, because a child is acting out, because they're smoking marijuana, that doesn't mean that they're good candidates for placement. Placement is really a last resort. So looking beyond placement, or I should say before preceding placement, we would look to this woman and say that it sounds like she could use some help with parenting, how to set limits. Oftentimes, parents who are dealing with unruly children continue to give in to them, whether they indulge them or they just are not able to set the boundary of what the kids need. And as much as the kids push the limits, they actually need it. I really refer to it as a firm and loving boundary, because boundaries cannot be set within the context of not having a relationship. There needs to be a relationship for the kids to bump up against something.
Right.
But at the same time, there needs to be somebody who can be firm and can be consistent. I think one of the things that I find when I inquire about histories and what parents are doing or not doing, parents will say the one thing that they don't do is they're not consistent in their follow-through. So they make many threats, and then they don't follow through. So it's often a good idea to follow through and also to be careful about the threats that are being made. I hear parents saying they're going to ground their kids for a year, mm-hmm. I think, or a month sometimes, and that's really unrealistic and really doesn't effectually impact the child. So you have to look at what the behavior is and what's an appropriate consequence.
Yeah. Actually, when you just mentioned the part about the being grounded for a period of time, as a teenager, I was grounded for life. And when my dad said grounded for life, I did what any probably 14-year-old would do. I ran away because life, you believe him.
Right.
So, yes, absolutely, I agree. That there needs to be the consistency. I know when I read this question that came over through an email, the first question that I had is, it says, you know, can I solve it with basic discipline? Well, that depends on what basic discipline means to you.
Exactly. Right.
So we got one that came in from a 16-year-old that says, I am a 16-year-old. My dad has threatened to send me away to boarding school, but I think my parents are the problem. That cracked me up. Not that we've never heard that. Is there any way I can stop this from happening? I really don't want to go to boarding school.
Well, I don't know that I can respond to this child specifically about putting on the brakes with this, but there are things called parentectomy, and I'm a firm believer that at times that it is in a family's best interest where the child is separated from the parents. And it's not, obviously, it's few and far in between, but there are some circumstances where the dynamics are such that the system is so dysfunctional that even with as much outpatient therapy that's provided for that family, it's just not enough. And a period of a separation can often help mitigate some of that tension. So it's very helpful.
I couldn't agree more. And we run into this from the transport side where we're picking them up and it's at 5 o'clock in the morning and the first thing they say is, you don't understand. There's nothing wrong with me. I come from a dysfunctional family. And they mm-hmm. proceed to tell us everything that's going on in the family and every claim that they have about what the parents have done wrong or their siblings or whatever. Our answer for that is very simple. The beauty of the program that you're going to is that they can help you deal with being raised in a dysfunctional family. That doesn't mean that, in other words, what you're telling me doesn't tell me that you shouldn't be going to this program. There are professionals that have worked with you and have worked with your whole family, and they've come to this conclusion, and it may very well be exactly what you're saying. So in other words, we don't jump on the bandwagon and say, yeah, I talked to your mom or I talked to your dad and they're whacked. It's if that's the case, you know, you're going to a program. If that's the case, then you're going to be in a position to be able to deal with those issues.
Yeah, I do believe that there are often, you know, placements that are mm-hmm. certainly warranted where the child at some point will recognize that. It mm-hmm. doesn't happen, and I would say at the onset during the escorting phase, but typically down the road, the child can in hindsight look back and appreciate the placement. But I do want to respond to the 16-year-old girl, actually, and mm-hmm. and maybe recommend this as far as negotiating. You know, oftentimes in my practice, I have families coming in, and I call them my on-the-fence families, which means they're not quite ready to move forward with placement, but they're trying to figure out if it's in their child's best interest. What I do in those cases is I will come up with some sort of contract or agreement. I like to call it an agreement as opposed mm-hmm. to a contract, a little binding for some of these families. But some sort of an agreement which says if the child is able to comply with certain requests and certain what I call appropriate things that parents are asking for in terms of behavior, then the parents will not look at placement as an option. If the child's not able to comply to the appropriate demands that are being asked of them, then placement is looked at as an option. And so if this child wants to negotiate with her parents, perhaps she can come up with her own behavioral contract for her parents to say, I'm willing to make these changes. If I can't make the changes, then I would agree and acquiesce that placement is necessary.
Right, right. And you're right. They need to learn negotiating skills and they need to turn it around. So many of the kids that we're dealing with, I mean, again, from the transport side, is saying, if I don't get A, B, and C, I'm going to do D.
Right.
Right. And we try to tell them the same thing that you're saying, which is you need to go in and say to the parents, if I do A, B, and C that you want, can I have D or not have D if it happens to be placement? So yes, if they can just turn that way that they're negotiating around and make it a positive, so I see your point and I agree.
And it does help to have the child actually being the one to come up with what's expected of them, because interestingly enough, children often are harder on themselves than parents can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Well, I've got another question that says, my family has a long history of alcoholism. My son has begun to show signs similar to the way my father was and the way I once was with alcohol, constantly drinking and sneaking alcohol. Should I find him a different environment for schooling, or are there different smaller steps I can take?
Well, that's another tricky question, mm-hmm. because placement isn't necessarily imminent in that case. Of course, imminent placement is always has to do with safety of a child.
Sure.
And I say that to parents right off the bat. As far as alcoholism, and I think that's very much tied into cultural concerns, is do I find another place? If we're looking at other local options, it's really hard to avoid placement in any kind of local setting where a child will not be exposed to some sort of drug or alcohol within that system. So moving a child from one school to another isn't necessarily the answer on a local level. And I
Right.
say that to parents all the time. They're looking to, can't we just move them? And I help them understand, especially if this is a biological issue and
mm-hmm.
addiction sounds like it runs in this family, and it may be a genetic loading that this child carries for addiction, which we need to certainly look at. If that's the case, this is a situation where, again, testing would probably be helpful, because you can rule in or rule out some of that through an evaluation to better understand how at risk this child is. Because if safety is an issue and this child is at risk, the mother may need to consider a residential placement for the child. I'm somebody that probably is a little bit, people may not agree with this theory, but I don't believe in pure drug and alcohol treatment for adolescents. I think that you really need to, especially with teenagers, look at the whole picture and understand what's driving it. Oftentimes, it can be underlying causes, depression, anxiety. And so without understanding, as I said, the bigger diagnostic picture where testing comes in, it's very hard to assess how to help a child. So in this case, it would be that testing would be recommended as a first step to, again, create that roadmap of figuring out what the second step would be.
Sure. Sure. No, I agree. And I think that it's really important for parents to understand, and we hear it too, where the parents will say, well, my child has to go away because they have an addiction. And I hear what you're saying, which is it the primary issue or is it a secondary issue? You know, if it's a secondary issue that they're using it to drown a deep depression or something, that's where the testing is going to help you find that out and hopefully make the right choice.
Right. I think kids today use self-medicate far too much.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the range of options? I know that there's a range. I don't know that all of our listeners do. What is the range of options for children needing placement?
As far as options, there are obviously higher level of cares when it is acute and a child needs to be hospitalized. And that is under, as I said, imminent circumstances where they need to go somewhere because they're either at risk of hurting themselves or somebody else.
Right.
And if that level of acuity requires hospitalization, that would be a first step for a family. And that would be a family contacting their local police department, the PET team. They
mm-hmm.
would come in and their psychiatrist,
right.
and they can initiate a temporary hold for that child, an involuntary hold where a child would be hospitalized for a period of time. That would be the highest level of care, and
right.
that would be, as I said, because danger was an issue.
Mm-hmm.
I would say stepping down from that, when we're looking at placement on a residential level, the next level of care down may be a wilderness program. So families who are looking at, sometimes families are looking at quick fixes, which they don't exist, unfortunately, but needing to rein kids in, needing to really break down their defenses to start the therapeutic process so that they can get in there and do the work, where so many of these kids are resistant to getting any kind of help. They've been
Right.
to therapists, they've seen therapists, they're not interested in therapy. So there's a huge barrier there. And I would say wilderness is used to really break down those barriers, bring down the wall so that you can penetrate, you can get in and effectively make change. That would be another higher level of care. Oftentimes, unfortunately, parents will see it, as I said, as a quick fix.
Well, as opposed to a stepping stone.
Exactly. I would say it's a launching pad for the next step, which would be a residential treatment center where children would go and live for a period of time. Typically, I would say minimum length of stay would be about 6 months. Anywhere up to about 2 years in a residential treatment center. Or there are also schools called therapeutic boarding schools where kids go, and it's a little bit of a lesser restrictive environment where kids are there for different reasons. Usually it's not a dual diagnosis intervention. That would be at the residential treatment level. But a therapeutic boarding school would be for kids who are acting out but really under control, not necessarily out of control at the point in which they enter the programs. And that, again, would be anywhere between 6 months and 2 years of a duration. From there, kids can step down into what are called transitional boarding schools. And so that would be, those would be programs that were geared towards kids who may have already been through the therapeutic process of either a wilderness program, a residential treatment center, or a therapeutic boarding school. So that would be a transitional step. Sometimes kids go to transitional programs straight from home because they don't need that higher level of structure. They just need a living environment, as I said earlier, away from their parents.
Right.
So,
right.
And then, of course, there are traditional boarding schools, or what we would call tweener schools, which is kind of in between a boarding school and a therapeutic program, where kids can step down even more when they're ready. So kids either would go from home if they're, it's an appropriate referral, or they would go from a step down, as a step down.
Right. As you were going through these, it was actually reminding me of a family where we transported their daughter first to a... to a wilderness program, which again was a stepping stone to the residential treatment center. She ran away from the resident. Oh, I'm sorry. She came home. She was home for a couple of months. She ran away. We located her. She went back to the residential treatment center. She came home. She was back for a couple months. She ran away again, and this time they chose to send her off to a different program. This time. She came home a couple months and ran away, and each time the father's having to contact me saying, can you go out and find her? So I said, yes, we can, but I need to sit down with you first. And I went and sat down with him, and I said, you know, we need to discuss, you know, the thing. And he says, that's right, we need to talk about this because these programs are failing. He goes, I don't understand. He says, I've spent so much money in their these programs are failing. You need to tell me what's going on with the situation. And I said, I don't know, what would you consider the common denominator? And he stopped for a minute. He went, what do you mean? And I said, you've gone to now three different programs, and your daughter's been very successful in the program. What's the common denominator? And he went, oh, it's us.
Yeah.
It took him a while, but he realized that each time it took about 2 months of being home for them to undo everything that was done because they had no structure, they had no boundaries. And with that, it allowed her to go right back into the same problems that she was having before. And it really wasn't until he got it to the point that he realized that he and his wife got into therapy themselves and really got into understanding what their job was as a parent till they finally got it for their daughter to finally succeed.
I think that's a good story. I think that represents a lot of what we deal with in this industry is parents. And that's why I said at the beginning, this isn't a process with kids going away or working with kids in a vacuum. It's looking at the whole system and why it's so critical for parents when there is placement involved and when children are going off to residential settings that parents also get parenting support along the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how do parents get their children to cooperate if they're unwilling to even go into the therapy for the testing?
Well, I always say to parents, that's good diagnostic information to start with.
Right.
We can't get them in the office, and that the parents have lost all control in getting their kids into an office. So I think that's useful information from the get-go. when I have that situation, it is a red flag for me, and it really does speak to the child needing more support, more structure, more of those boundaries that we're talking about. And if a child cannot get there, it will often be an indicator that placement may need to be on the table. If we're talking about how to get a child to placement, I think you're probably the best one to answer that, Alan. I often do use escorts. I think even though it may sound worse than it actually is, any parent I've ever spoken with after the process, when their child has been picked up by an escort, they all say how the experience was ran so smoothly, and it was such an easy process that they're amazed in which the, you know, as far as the expertise of the people coming in to pick up their children and the calmness in which their children react to a stranger coming into the home. I think all of those things, it's incredibly shocking to parents when they hear or when they have the experience of sending their kids via escort.
Well, one of the things that I tell parents in those situations is, it's not magic. And you know, I'll get parents that'll go, but you don't understand. I mean, they're never going to go. They're never going to. And when I had an 8-year-old, and I don't any longer, they're a little older now, but and I would tell a parent, I'd say, you would probably have a better chance at getting my 8-year-old to go to bed at 8:30 when he is supposed to. Because I will hear, can I get a glass of water? Can I get a glass of milk? Can you rub my back? Can you read me another story? All of these things go on because he already knows my buttons. So now, as I'm explaining to this parent, you know, your child has had 15 years of learning your buttons. When we arrive there, they don't know our buttons. That's the biggest advantage that we have, that we're going to go in there, we're going to keep them safe, we're going to treat them with respect. But the biggest key is the fact that the child does not know our buttons yet. And I think that helps the parents to understand, they feel a little bit better about the situation rather than feeling like, well, I can't believe I can't do this myself. So, but you're right, it is generally a lot more of a calm environment than what the parents ever envision. It's not magic.
Yeah, and the other thing I do in my practice is I have parents speak with other parents ahead of time so that they really can get an idea of what this process is about without relying on me or the escorts to share their stories. I think hearing it live from another parent of their experience of what it was like, whether it was what it was like to have an escort come into their home, what it was like to go through the placement process in general, and to come out the other end. I think that's the most helpful thing, that one parent talking to another parent, as far as this placement process in general.
Yeah, I think that's great too, is for not only the transport, but as you said, for be it going to Wilderness or going to a residential treatment center. I know one of the questions that I didn't ask but it's also one of the things that I'm interested in as well is, what does the usual psychological or academic test entail? Give us a little bit more, because I think that's an area that even some of us in the industry don't fully understand.
There are really two very separate components of the evaluation. So when I break it down for families, as I said, I break it down into basically four components. The psychological probably being one of the more interesting components when families sit and hear the feedback, because it's really an in-depth profile of what their child looks like within their internal world. So what, as far as the evaluations, the tests that are implemented or utilized are objective tests. So we give the MMPI, which is the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, another test called the MACI, which is an objective test. It's the Milan Inventory for teenagers. And then we give projective tests, such as the Rorschach, which is always an interesting test. There's some controversy around that, but I would say that's probably one of the most fruitful tests within psychological testing, if somebody knows what they're doing. And so you really have to know how to, it's almost like learning a new language to use the Rorschach. So the Rorschach is used. There's a test called the thematic apperception test. There's a test called the Roberts apperception test. There are drawings, there are sentences in which the children complete, and then there are checklists, behavioral checklists that are given to the children, that are given to the parents, as well as teachers. So you're looking at, you know, beyond what's going on as far as what's being self-reported by the child in those checklists, you're looking at a deeper layer here, more of what's going on at that unconscious level of trying to tap into things that where that resistance comes up. We can penetrate that, get through that, and open up, like I said, the door. I call it the back door to mm-hmm. parents, so we can get in. Where kids who have been in therapy for maybe 1, sometimes 2 years, we get more information through 8 hours of testing than they can acquire within 2 years of therapy. So it does, like I said, if you're going and doing this type of evaluation, that's not done through the school district, and I probably should make that clear. This is testing that's only, unfortunately, done privately. So when you go to the school district, there's no quote-unquote psychological testing that's done. It's really primarily educational testing.
Okay, and is there any way in which they ever pick it up, that they ever pick up the expense?
Yes, they okay. will. It just depends the circumstances. That's, again, another case where an advocate may step in. They have people that typically they contract with in which they will support the testing that's done. Unfortunately, most of that testing, most of that testing is neuropsychological testing. So we're in a little bit of a different domain when we hit the psychological testing. That's more the Department of Mental Health.
Right.
So we're crossing borders here as far as who's involved. But when it comes to emotional issues, that type of testing, as I said, gives you more information than one would acquire through several years sometimes of therapy.
Right, yeah. And for those that have ever had to deal with bureaucracies, that just means the money comes out of a different pocket.
Correct, yes, exactly.
Because you'll have them arguing that, no, that comes out of county mental health. And somebody else will say, no, well, that comes out of probation. That comes out of juvenile justice. That comes out of education. And the bottom line is you're just going, wait a minute, can we just get the child some help?
Right.
Okay, let me make sure that I cover all the listener questions because we've only got about 15 more minutes. It says, I found pot in my kid's room, just a couple of joints worth. Is this cause for concern? I used to smoke weed as a kid. Should I just let it go or should I mention it?
Well, that's another question. Like I said, when I tell parents, when parents question, does my child need placement? I don't think this mother's asking if their child needs placement, but you know, because they're smoking pot, I explain to them, if we send every child away who is smoking pot, I think our schools would virtually be empty.
That's right.
So as far as the level of concern, I do think it should be brought to kids' attention when parents find drugs, any kind of drugs, mm-hmm. any kind of paraphernalia. I think, you know, I know parents will try and do a covert operation. They'll read their child's diary. They'll snoop through their room and not say anything to the kids. And I don't think that's the best tactic to really be honest. We're expecting our children to be honest. And I think it's important to be upfront, forthright, and honest with our children as well as parents. So in terms of going in, I think it sounds like that warrants a sit down, a
sure.
family powwow to discuss what it's about, to try and get more information from that child, for parents to do their own assessment whether or not this is something serious, whether it's experimental, how frequently the kids are using. I mean, kids don't always come forth with the information, but I think it's important for an open dialogue to be started between parents and their kids, probably at a younger age before they find the drugs,
right.
for that to happen, for that matter. But I think that dialogue should be, you know, open. The door should be open to discuss it and for kids to know that their parents are watching them. That's the other thing that's important, that they're not flying under the radar, that parents are onto them and that they will be, whether it means implementing a drug testing program, something where they can randomly drug test to continue to assess, like I said, the condition, how serious it is, and if they need to intervene at another level.
Absolutely. And for parents out there, they don't want you as their best friend. They want you as their parent. So be the parent. One of the questions, which actually works perfectly, and it is, how can I get in contact with you to talk to you about my teen? So apparently somebody saw in the press release and has already emailed us. So can you give us your website and your phone number on how people can get in touch with you?
Sure. The website is thestepgroup.com. And our phone number, we're located, our offices are in the San Fernando Valley in California. However, we work with families across the country, so it really is not just relegated to that area. But the phone number is 818-996-9880.
Hey, that's a great point you brought up, and I didn't know that. So in regards to the testing, is the testing something that can be done where you're not looking at somebody? I mean, how if you have a family that's in Michigan and you're working with them and you're doing the testing, are you still able to take care of everything that's needed?
Typically in those cases, I'll find someone who locally can lay their eyes on the kids so that there's a face-to-face experience. Testing cannot, unfortunately, be done over the phone. It has to be done as an experiential process where you're administering tests and there's a give and take within that experience. So the placement, however, isn't always tied into testing. There are a lot of times where families will come to me for placement where their child has already been assessed, sometimes has been assessed multiple times over the course of several years. So when we're doing placement, it's in those cases, we're working with families who may have already had the testing, and that way we can use the testing that's been done as that roadmap for placement. So placement's a lot easier to do via phone. We do it sometimes over a webcam, so we have direct contact with parents. They can actually see us, we can see them, and it makes for a better relationship in terms of building a rapport, because this is, as far as a relationship, this is an ongoing relationship that can last several years. So you do want to have that kind of contact with parents.
Well, we with this show, we reach other countries, and there are people that we do contact in other countries that do email us. Are you working with any families out of the country, and or have you? And if so, what is the process in regards to getting them in?
Sometimes families, we do work with families across the country, out of the country, I would say all over. The need for placement has grown, I would say, exponentially over the past 5 years. It's really amazing. But as far as families coming in, as I said, they don't need to necessarily come in, fly in, and be face-to-face with us. We can do it through over the phone, through a webcam, where we can acquire all the information that we need to do our diagnostic assessment without formal testing, and then be able to use that information to figure out placements for those kids, whether it's a regular boarding school, whether it's a therapeutic school, whatever it might be. So placements can be done from a remote location, which is really nice for the families, especially for families in situations where there aren't resources in their local areas, which is the case for many, many families across the country and certainly outside of the country.
Yeah, and I agree. And we're seeing it more and more of people coming in from other countries, which I think there's multiple reasons. I mean, one is that, you know, we have more good programs here in the United States. But I think it's also the fact that, you know, our economy is such now that the economy is stronger in many other countries, and they can now afford to get their kids over here. So when they're making their decision saying we want our child to either go to the best school or our child that's dealing with a particular issue, that they want them still to be able to come to the United States.
Yeah, I would say probably do more of the boarding school placements in those cases. So families, international families looking for boarding school placements is very, very common. Has been for years, actually.
All right, well, I've got one more listener question. This way I can say that I got them all in. It says, should I tell my teen that he is getting sent away in a few months if they are in the habit of lashing out, sometimes to the point of damaging property and threatening me?
Well, I think empty threats can be pretty dangerous. I don't know if this parent is really, their plan is to send their child away or just to make the threat. So I think the threats don't work, and that's why I was going back to what I was saying earlier. If you're going to make threats or put a punishment out there, make sure that it's something that you can follow through with. I say to parents when I talk about that contract that we put together for the purpose or agreement that we put together for the purpose of determining if a child needs placement or not, that they have to be ready to follow through if the agreement is broken. So that's something that's really critical for this particular parent to understand that if the intention is to send them, that probably 2 months in advance is too far in advance as far as giving them fair warning. Typically, if a child is going to placement and if it's more driven by concerns related to behavioral issues, you have to be careful because the behaviors can really escalate. As you gave the example, Alan, of finding out that when you were being, you know, punished for life, same thing. If kids find out they're being sent away, they can do something to, whether they run away, whether they hurt themselves, potentially hurt somebody else. They've seen them become very destructive with property. So you really have to assess if it's appropriate to tell the kids. That's why escorts are used, mm-hmm. because sometimes kids and families are in positions where it's not in the child's best interest to find out ahead of time. And sometimes it is. And that's where educational consultants come in, certainly, to help the family assess what is the best and safest way, if we're doing a placement, to get the child to the facility. Is it using an escort? Is it having a child come in? And typically, I'm the one to share it with them, mm-hmm. or to feel them out. Sometimes I say, what do you think of the idea of going away? Mm-hmm. And they say, I'm not going anywhere. So it's very helpful to get that feedback from the kids directly and use that as information of how to proceed with placement and in what way to get them to the
school. Well, and so, you bring up a good point, and I'll add to that, but the way that you just explained it, you're not giving them a finite answer. You're asking them a question, and you're getting their opinion. Oftentimes in dealing with the parents, we're hearing the parents say, well, you know, I don't want to lie to them. I want to make sure that I tell them that this is what's going to happen. And the ones that feel like they have to do that, what I'll try to tell them is, don't give them a finite thing. Don't say, look, you're going, we've set a flight, they're coming here on Thursday, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning, you're going to be on that flight. If you give them a finite thing, you're, first of all, you're causing a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress, and it's very possible that they're going to run away. As opposed to, if you discuss it as you did, ask them their feeling about it. Let them tell you what they're going to say. And if at that point in time, you know, if you want to then say, well, we're going to have to discuss this with our therapist, our ed consultant, or whoever, because we still believe that it's a very valid, you know, thing that we feel that needs to be done. But don't say, as you're speaking to them on Friday, this is going to happen Monday morning, because guess what? They won't be around Monday morning.
Right.
So don't give a finite. Buy some time that allows you to then, you know, talk with the professionals that you've been dealing with, get in touch with, you know, if they're recommending transport, get in touch with somebody to make sure that that gets done and that we're not also having to go find them.
Right. And I call it planting the seeds without threats.
Yes.
I think that's important for kids to know that their parents are contemplating this, but not necessarily pulling the trigger.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the therapy side and a little bit about the ed consulting side. Go ahead and tell us a little bit more about the job that an educational consultant does, because I get parents that if I tell them, in fact, I'll get contacted, I want you to find my runaway child, and I'll go, what's your plan? I go, what do you mean my plan? I want you to find him and bring him home. I understand, but as I'm reading the history, it says they've run away 7 times. What's your plan when we get them home? I don't know. Let me introduce you to an educational consultant in your area that can help you with this. He goes, well, what are you saying? I'm saying I'm not going to find your child and then just have them turn around and run away. And if they don't run away tomorrow or the next week, they're going to run away the next conflict. Get a plan. And from that standpoint, when we locate your child, maybe we aren't bringing him straight back to you, because so far that hasn't been working. So, for those parents that are out there, explain to them a little bit about what an educational consultant can do for them.
I think you're bringing up a really good point in terms of having plans, and I think it's the job of the educational consultant to create the plan. And so in terms of the role of what somebody does as an educational consultant and what their background is, it's actually an interesting field because there's a vast range as far as professionals within mm-hmm. who do this type of placement. Personally, I do think it requires, especially if one is working with kids with behavioral and emotional concerns, that it does help to have a clinical background. So in terms of that, my background as a psychologist helps me in working with families. But the job of a consultant is certainly one that's a job that requires one to have a lot of patience, a lot of good foresight, and good planning techniques. Sometimes it's like playing a chess game and having to have strategies and plans before it's actually your turn to make the move. So figuring out from the get-go, using your own diagnostic evaluation, whether it's formal testing, whether it's an informal evaluation, but gathering as much information as one can through the family, through the child, if you can get the child in the office, which you said is not always easy to do, through the professionals involved in that child's care. Typically, it's very rare for me to do a placement if the child hasn't been in multiple therapies, worked with sometimes multiple psychiatrists. So there are a lot of professionals who have been involved along the way and teachers to get feedback from. Using all that information to figure out what the next step would be. I would say placement is never a one-pronged step. There are always multiple steps within the process. So in doing placement, one wants to figure out where they're going and have a good sense, a good direction of understanding that it will require time and monitoring a child over an extended period of time to take them through the various different transitional steps we talked about.
Well, speaking of time, I can't believe it, but we're out of it. Danny, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. Once again, time has gone by so quick. If anybody has any additional questions, again, give them the website.
It's www.thestepgroup.com.
And the phone number?
818-996-9880.
And you can also send your questions to us, Answers for the Family. That's answers, the numeral for, thefamily.com. We appreciate all of you that are out there listening. Be back next week, and we will do this again. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.